So it is August 19th, 2015, and I'm Sean Kutzko, and we are talking with Jeff Machota, who used to work at Nature's Table in Urbana, Illinois. Jeff, where are you from?
I'm from Cicero, Illinois.
Cicero, Illinois. And we're here at your house on Poplar Street in East Urbana. How did you end up in Champaign?
I came here to go to the U of I.
And what year was that?
In the fall of 1984.
Okay. And how did you end up finding out about Nature's Table?
So I lived in Allen Hall, which was a more progressive dorm on campus and had a history of music and politics. And I'd known people who'd gone down here, and those I liked really liked it. Those I didn't like hated it, so I figured I would like it. And we came down on one of those, I came down with my parents on one of those college tour things. So it was probably the summer of 84. And I broke off from the tour because I was bored. I let my parents do it. And I found the Channing Murray / Red Herring, and I found Nature's Table. And of course, neither were open because it was summertime. So as soon as I got on campus, like the first night, I went to Nature's Table and found it and started hanging out there pretty much like the first week. And I got somebody who was lived next to me in the dorms who ended up becoming a really good friend of mine. And we, George Patamianos. And we ended up going a lot to hear a bunch of music. And there was, you know, during the week, I think the first or second band I saw was Oscar Sully and his wife at the time, who was a drummer. And she played kit drum, and he played guitar, flute, everything else, just duets. That was like the second night, I think, I was there. So I was an avid person going there a lot. Then I got involved in a lot of political work on campus. I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement, and one of the people that I was in that worked in the anti-apartheid movement worked at Nature's Table, Teresa Donnelly. And the first job I got down here the summer of 85 was at Papa Del's, and that sucked. I couldn't eat pizza for like a year after that, but I was on the Wright Street location. And all these people would quit, and the manager would keep them on the schedule because people quit because it sucked. And Pops was a cheap ass. And
I worked at that location, too, for a while.
So one day, Teresa calls me and says, "There's a help. Terry put up a Help Wanted poster. I tore it down. You had to come over here right away." So like that day, or like as soon as I could the next day, I went over there, I applied for the job, and got it. At Nature's Table. So this was probably like September. It was like right when the semester was starting up, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I basically just quit Papa Del's right away. I didn't feel the compunction to give them 2 weeks' notice because I had been on shifts that were supposed to have like six people that had like three. Mm-hmm. Because the manager was dumb. So I started working at Nature's Table then in the like end of the summer of 85. And I worked there till the last day, or till a few days after the last day, in May of 91.
So, what was your first impression of Terry?
Terry, my first impression was, I was trying to get the job. He was very friendly, but very, very curt, and he knew Teresa had recommended me. So he hired me. So I guess that's probably my first impression. I mean, I don't recall if I'd seen him around while I was hanging out or not. Here's my first pre-work story.
Okay.
So we would go there, me and George, and we would get a pitcher of beer and a loaf of wheat bread. And we'd probably Augsburger Dark. We would drink the beer and eat the wheat bread and listen to jazz. And we were cool. And then occasionally we'd buy a loaf of bread to take back to the dorm. And one night we're in there, and Darius, I didn't know him at the time. I knew his name was Darius. His name is Darius Archer, I believe, was one of the employees. This is before I was working there, so this is 84. And we're in there on a Saturday night. And it's the end of the night, and we're there, and we're like, hey, can we buy a loaf of bread? And he's like, actually, there's a whole bunch of bread left over. You can have a whole bunch. So he gave us like 20 loaves of bread. So I kick ass. And so we're like going back to the dorm. We're giving, you know, we're giving people bread and all this stuff. Like, this is great. And years later, I tell Terry this story. And Terry's like, that fucking dumbass. Because what they did on Saturday, now you might remember working pasta Sundays. Uh-huh. They didn't make bread on Sundays, but so there was extra bread made on Saturdays. So for pasta Sunday, there'd be enough for garlic bread. And Darius gave it all away. So that was pretty funny. He's also the one, Darius is the one who broke the cash register, which is why when we worked there, there was nothing no but cash the cash register. Yeah, just
which
the drawer.
Is, which is, that's been really strange, you know, when we found these, when we've come across these tapes from the early days, you know, Ron Dewar or playing those gigs, and we hear the cash register in the background. Yeah, I never encountered anything like that. So.
To explain for the studio audience.
Yes.
All we had was, since the kitchen was recessed, it was down a step for whatever crazy reason. So people came to the counter, and if you were Sean's height, it was fine. If you were my height, everybody was like towering over us because they're already a step up. And so we had the counter, and then underneath it was just a little cart, a little food service cart. And on that was the cash drawer. And everything was rounded pretty much to the quarter. And we just, no register, we just made change, added up in our heads and made change.
Mm-hmm. It's very loose. So what is your understanding of how Nature's Table came to be in the first place?
Terry was a football player. He was down here, I think he came here in 69, if I believe, or 68. I can't remember which one. I think he was born in 50, so probably 68. He was 18. He was on the football team. He was an MVP one year for being a punter because was so bad.
And this is on the Fighting Illini football team?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He graduated, ended up in Florida for a while. And I think there got exposed to the Whole Foods stuff. So this is 77, 78. So at this point, wheat bread is not something that anybody knows what it is. I mean, in general. You can't go to a grocery store and get wheat bread. You couldn't really easily get any of this stuff. So I think he had encountered a place or two in Florida and decided he wanted to come back here and do it.
Okay.
And he and Jeff Cross, who was a buddy, I don't think Jeff was ever a football player, but they were college buddies. They went in together and opened up Nature's Table. And it was just meant to be a Whole Foods place. That's why the sign is even like Nature's Table Restaurant and Coffee House. Mm-hmm. And so they started it up. I don't think Jeff was ever really hands-on. I think he may have just helped out with the capital and resources. Jeff's a pretty resourceful guy. I've heard different stories that, you know, over time, never any chronological thing of what happened. Mm-hmm. But so then he had that going, and he was at the Ground Round one night.
Terry was. Okay.
And so the Ground Round, so on Neal Street, South Neal Street. Mm-hmm. And he was in there, and I'd never been to the Ground Round here. I'd been to the ones up in Chicago area when I was a kid. So and they would have music at times. They were in the old, they used to have, did you ever go to those?
Yeah, a couple of times. So usually a couple of guitar players, acoustic stuff.
They would, I mean, their thing was they would show like Three Stooges films. They would show Three Stooges. They'd show black and white comedies. They'd have barrels of peanuts and popcorn. It was a pub thing. And it was old-timey things, so they would occasionally have music. So down here, I'm not sure how often they had it, but they had music. So we saw the Jack Webb Band, which featured Ron Dewar, a bunch of people. A bunch of... Mike Miller was in it. So he saw them, and he was blown away, and he was like, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. So he approached him. He didn't realize that the name Jack Webb was after the Dragnet character, and he wasn't sure which one was Jack. I don't think he knew anybody at that point. But so he asked him to play. They ended up not being the first band to play, so I don't know how that worked out, because I know that's what he said inspired him to do it. I think the very first band was Dave Dreyer and Brian Wilkie were the very first performers. Their mm-hmm. duets.
Okay, let's back up a minute. Sure. So Nature's Table opened when?
It opened in 1979.
Do you remember the month?
I don't know if I know the month or not. Okay. I want to say it was mid-year.
Okay.
The transition, like, it was only a few months before I started doing music.
Right.
It wasn't a long time. So I think he may have opened probably the spring of 79. By the fall of 79, he was doing music.
Okay.
So that's loose. I'm not sure of exact stuff on that. But I know that by the fall of 79, he was doing music. Mm-hmm. Because some of the first things we have are from fall of 79 and then early 80. Mm-hmm. So that was really when it started happening. Mm-hmm. And we started doing that pretty early on.
Okay. I remember now. Nature's Table is at 509 South Goodwin in Urbana. It's right across the street from Cranert Center for the Performing Arts.
Was.
I remember that that used to be Pantera's Pizza mm-hmm. before that. Do you remember anything about what it was before that? No? Okay.
No. There was, I think, a Spud Nuts next door. So it was in a little strip mall, mm-hmm. kind of. A strip building. It was three buildings put together. Right. That were on a main street, so it wasn't really a strip mall, but just an old school kind of three buildings, and that was a pizza place. I'm not sure how recently before it was. I believe the place in the middle was Spud Nuts.
See, I don't recall anything
Spud Nuts was in where the table was, because some people who have been around longer, mm-hmm. Spud Nuts was a donut shop from what I hear.
Okay.
And then, I mean, by the time I got here in 84, Horizon Books was on the southernmost portion. The middle part was abandoned the entire time I worked there.
Right.
And the I'm not sure if the Durso family owned the table building. They had a shoe repair for a while. It was above where Cam's was.
Okay.
And there was old man Durso, then there was some people who were like, I think Terry may have known one of the younger Dursos, which was his age. Mm-hmm. That may be how he got the space.
Okay.
I mean, eventually, Dale owned his portion, his third, which was Horizon Books. The U of I bought the middle, and that's why it was nothing for a long time, because mm-hmm. they had sites on that building for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then Durso owned that other place till the end. So Terry was a renter. But Durso was a pretty hands-off landlord. So Terry had cheap rent, but that meant that he had to do a lot of the upkeep.
Right.
And he did a lot. There was a lot of renovations that were done inside. It, from what you and I knew, it radically shifted where the bands were mm-hmm. and the door. So they did that stuff, and there was other changes made in there. Mm-hmm. All that was done on Terry's dime. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he opens sometime in 1979, starts having music there late 79, early 1980. How do you have any idea of how the community, how the table was received in the community in the first years? Do you have any info on that?
What the strain was, so we have to go to the U of I and to John Garvey. Mm-hmm. So John Garvey came here, I believe, the late 50s, very early 60s. He was originally hired to do the Russian folk orchestra. Or no, not Russian, just classical stuff. Mm-hmm. He was a bigwig classical guy. Russian folk orchestra was later. But he was a big classical guy. And I'm not the expert on Garvey. But at some point, soon after he was here, he basically started up a jazz program. And jazz was still pretty shit on by the School of Music. It was not legit music. But they let Garvey carve this thing out. And it was never, you could never get a degree until like the past 10 years. You could never get a degree in jazz performance. Hmm. That's the past 10 years from now. So the whole time, so people were basically, if they were music majors, they were going to be teachers or classical performance and not jazz. But there ended up being, I think at the peak, four jazz bands. He formed the Russian Folk Orchestra as a side thing too. So John Garvey ended up, and again, I'm not the historian on this, but with four jazz bands at some point where the program expanded, even though it wasn't a degree program. And lots of people came through here because John was doing stuff at the Cutting Edge, and a lot of people came to the U of I. Some people came to study with him. Jim McNeely was one of the early people in the band. Ron Duar was in the band. Joe Farrell was a sax player, who was, I think, Joe Ferentino back then. But a lot of people. So there was this scene at the U of I that had been cultivated and that was going on. So that had been going, went strong through the 60s and the 70s. You know, the Ron and Cecil Bridgewater were in it. D.D. Bridgewater was in it. They would go to Russia. And then there was still a pretty strong community jazz scene as well. There was historic roots here. There were the Bridgewaters were from here. And then not just Ron and Cecil, but their uncle was a player. There used to be a lot of music. And Champaign was back when there was more of a circuit. People would go from Chicago to St. Louis and would stop in Champaign. Mm-hmm. So they would be looking for gigs. So Champaign had Champaign, Danville, Indy. There was a lot of crossover from Indy. So there was a hotbed of black performers that had been here for a long time performing jazz. Then there was this U of I stuff. So there's this whole backdrop of Champaign being a nexus for a lot of this stuff. So I believe when the table came around, you know, so as you know, things go in cycles. So all of a sudden there's five clubs, then there's none. Mm-hmm. Then there's, you know, a place. So I think the table kind of hit it at a moment when some other places were waning or doing less. Zorba's, I think, had stopped doing jazz at that point. Zorba's had been a place that did a lot of jazz. Ron Duar used to play there. It's actually in the mural, I think, which is still there. Part of it's still there. So there had been a lot of music playing around the U of I, and since it was so centrally located, since it was right across from Cranor, two blocks from the School of Music, I think the table was adopted pretty early on by a lot of people.
Okay.
And it kind of broke into two pretty clear segments. A lot of the people were there from 79 to 80 to 84. So by the time I started coming around, and by 85, a lot of people who had worked there and played there had moved on.
Mm-hmm. And so they'd moved to Chicago. They had graduated.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they graduated, or they just decided they were moving up to Chicago, or both.
Okay. So then you came along.
People like Joel Spencer, Mike Coker, Brad Wheeler, a lot of people who were in Garv's band came here to study. Some of them may have done graduate work as well, but then they moved up to Chicago. So they played at the table a lot. They came down then from Chicago to play at the table, but a lot of people talk about the influence the table had on them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people were in that first wave.
Can you name some of the other folks that were part of the first wave? Like Ray Sasaki would have been part of the first wave?
Is Ray that Sasaki. Right? But Ray was around later as well. Mm-hmm. He didn't leave. Morgan Powell. But people like Joan Hickey. Ron Duar was the big one for a lot of people. People were even coming down to play. Like Lynn Halliday came down to play quite a bit. It started to get known as a place to come. So people would come from Chicago for gigs. Mm-hmm. And as the people were starting to move up there to come back too. So those were some of the big names, as well as some like names that were established that had come down. Because people would actually play. Sometimes there was people who would play a Cranor gig and would come over and do stuff. Dave Liebman played there. But that's probably a little in the latter period of the first half.
I remember seeing photos of Herb Ellis playing there too.
Herb Ellis, I think he played there after a Cranor gig.
Okay,
I believe, but okay. I was not there.
Were there any other high profile names that you know of that played there
in that first period? Mm-hmm. Well, Von Freeman was starting to come down. Nothing I can think of right now.
Okay, so. Okay, so Terry sets up the place in 79, brings in a new way of eating, brings in an established music here in Champaign-Urbana. Jazz was very big by what you were describing, but on a nationwide basis, the late 70s was a really bad time for jazz. because it seemed like the music kind of died off for a while.
Commercially. Mm-hmm. There were still big bands happening. Mm-hmm. There was still like the Thad and Mel band and other bands and Ray Charles's band, Duke's band, Basie's band, even if they were somewhat ghost bands. So you could still actually make a living playing jazz, even in the late 70s, even throughout the 80s, you could make a living playing mm-hmm. jazz in Chicago. Mm-hmm. From stories Brad Wheeler tells me.
Okay.
Like you could play a gig in Chicago and then go to one or two after gigs after your gig, and there was a lot of support. I mean, that kind of, it really dried up by the end of the 80s mm-hmm. into the early 90s.
So, the table is established. It's doing well. Lots of people are playing there. Lots of people are...
I don't know if it's doing well.
Well, okay. Talk about that. What do you know about that?
From what Terry told me, it didn't really start to make money until the last couple years it was open.
Okay.
Like, really, like, make money. And that was part of some of us pushing things and taking control, because at that point he had zero kids when he started. He had four kids by the time he was done. Mm-hmm. So we survived the late 80s on the lunch business. Mm-hmm. and some of the weekend stuff. I mean, I worked Tuesday nights with some phenomenal music for 15 people,
right?
So that doesn't really make bank. Mm-hmm. Especially if they're just sipping some water.
So,
Or tea.
The tea was really good, though.
It was good. I'm not saying it wasn't, but you know, you can't pay the power bill with a person getting, what, a 50-cent glass of tea or whatever mm-hmm. ridiculous price it was, and nursing it the whole night.
Did it always have a lunch aspect to it, or did that come later?
I don't know. I would assume so. Mm-hmm.
But that would the lunch, the restaurant aspect, the lunch business was established by the time you started working there.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I would assume that Terry did it from the start, because that's the place to make the money. I mean, that's where we always made money, because mm-hmm. we're on the university campus,
right
next to all the medical science buildings and Krannert and that. So I think it was. I think it was from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I mean, dinner was never... I mean, even in later years, dinner was always in that... I mean, that was a
triple. It tried.
Yeah, there was like a few hiccups and burps, but it was, you know, lunch was where we... I mean, shit, by the time, you know, in the later years, there was lines out the door mm-hmm. for lunch.
Yeah, I remember a few lunches like that. Okay, so the first wave ends approximately 84. You were there for the second wave.
I was there for the transition. When I started working there, there were people had been working there for a few years that were moving on. Mm-hmm. Just like at Allen Hall, when I came to Allen Hall, there were a lot of people had been there that were musicians and moving on. So there was kind of a transition. Mm-hmm. The 70s took longer to die in Champaign-Urbana than...
there's part of me that's grateful for that.
It wasn't a criticism.
Right.
So there were people who had been working there a few years. When I started working, I mean, it's like, God, who was there? Like Mark Stryker was there.
Jeff Michael had been there for a while at this point?
Yeah, Jeff Michael had been there.
Okay.
Naomi, I forget Naomi's last name. Teresa was there. I don't remember. It starts to become a blur mm-hmm. because then I was... even hiring people later, so I don't even...
I wanted to get to that.
I don't remember that,
So when did... you know, you basically ran the show for the latter years. When did that happen? How did that evolve?
Yeah, well, I would say... you know, within a year or so. Mm-hmm. I mean... so Shelley was pregnant with the twins. I think when the twins came, that was even more... more time on Terry. Mm-hmm. But we had, you know, things had gotten, were working pretty smoothly at lunchtime. Some of us were really, you know, started pushing him. At one point, I don't remember what point he basically wanted me to hire people and run things, probably after a year or so. Mm-hmm. So It's about 86 or so, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think I did all the hiring. He still hired people. But I did all the scheduling. He booked all the bands. I never booked a single band there until the closing weekend.
Hmm.
Terry did all the booking. And Shelley did most of the schedules. Near the end, Brian Ruth and I took over doing the schedules, printing them up. And we pushed Terry. So a lot of the big name jazz, the heavy hitters, had moved on. And there was a period. And then, like, when Chuck Tripp moved to Chicago and Sorgan wasn't playing as much, we had kind of pushed Terry. He wish he did it. I mean, it wasn't like he was, like, begrudgingly, but to do a little more blues and R&B stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because then Catfish and Carter played, and they tore the place up.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bantuku was really big. So there started to be... Some of the early table people were a little like, oh, well, it's not all jazz anymore.
Right.
And then, you know, we diversified more. I'm not saying it wasn't from the beginning, but then there was more, like, Sunday night folk night, and then Sunday night... Well, there was a Sunday night jam session, then it became Sunday night folk night. And then, you know, the last few years, Brian Ruth managed to get Monday night rock night.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's looking back, it's all these proto bands that became big that were playing at Nature's Table. It's kind of funny.
So Menthol played there?
I don't know, I think that was before them.
Yeah.
But a precursor of Hum played there.
I remember
one of the original
that.
Versions of Hum. The Shakes with Dave Teitelbaum. And that was just a bunch of bands and a bunch of names of people. Even if that wasn't the bands that went on, it was people who went on to do stuff. But so we loosened it a little more because we needed... People weren't coming out. Some of the early generation weren't coming out as much. And the jazz happened during the week a lot, but again, sometimes there was audience issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard to go out 7 days a week.
Yes, it is.
Even when you're 22.
Uh-huh.
So
now, so the table was initially known for food and jazz. And then by the time I got there in... April of 87.
Okay.
Maybe May.
Did I hire you?
No.
Or Terry did.
Terry hired me.
Yeah.
That's an interesting story. But by the time I got there, there was already... it was already a well-established fact that the table was... you could go there and you could see local art... You could engage in all kinds of conversations with other people in the progressive community. It became like a hub for jazz musicians, other musicians, people who just like good food, progressive folks.
That was intentional. I mean, a lot of that was Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
So Shelley came into the picture not... too far from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
She was a dancer, and she met Terry at the table,
mm-hmm.
coming to the table, and she had studied stuff like these intentional places, like intentional community type things, and spaces that were open to that, and she brought a lot of that in. I mean, I'm not saying Terry wasn't open to that, because that was kind of Terry's initial idea, but I think she pushed some of that, too. So, I mean, we there were art openings we would do once a month where Terry would provide wine and apples and bread and brie, and we'd have art openings and have local art on the walls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was a space for all that. So I remember many afternoons hanging out after the lunch rush with the people. It was a place where people could talk, could bullshit,
mm-hmm.
could, you know... I mean, a lot of us in the later 80s were political activists, who were working there. Some of us loved jazz, some of us didn't necessarily, but, I mean, not everybody who worked there loved jazz. Some people loved music or just loved the environment and the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there were battles about that.
Such as
the fucking Joe Walsh stuff. Whoops. That Liz made reference to.
Okay. So... It becomes a community hub. There was a lot of cross pollination between the table and WEFT and some of the
I'm not sure how
stuff.
Much cross pollination there was with WEFT early on.
Oh, I don't know about early on, but you know, I became an airshifter at WEFT in '84, and I didn't start working at the table until 87.
Okay. People like Ev Heath. I don't know if you remember Ev Heath. He had shows at WEFT, and he would do some of the live music. He used to come out a lot. Actually, I strike when I said, yeah, you're right. Because then people would play on WEFT. I mean, like, I have a recording of Kevin Kaiser playing on WEFT in, like, 87 or so with Tim McNamara and this big horn band. It was a U of I thing, but it was also a table thing. So, yeah. So there was... I mean, it was natural. I mean, WEFT did a lot more live music at that point, too. Not saying it doesn't do now, but there was just... It was looser, so you could, you know, bands could show up and play.
Right.
There's another thing, another big factor too, is, and I'm going to be a little fuzzy on this date as well. I believe it was probably like 82 or so that Guido Sinclair came down here.
Oh yes, Guido. We can't talk about the table without talking about Guido.
Yeah. So maybe 82 or 83. So some of the early, no, it's probably 82. Some of the early people have different impressions of Guido, which he engendered. So, Guido had been all over the place, Texas, California, Chicago. He was pretty big in the Chicago scene and the bebop scene in the late 70s. He actually showed me a picture once of him on the front page of the Tempo section, which was the art section in the Tribune, which was pretty big, and horribly plaid sports jacket on. Wish I had a copy of that. So he's pretty big. He got pretty addicted to heroin, and I've heard this story. I don't remember exactly, but he and his girlfriend at the time heard about Champagne, heard about the table, and thought that he could get away and kick and come down here. And he ended up at, I believe, was it Phoenix House? Or there was like a hippie-run drug rehab place that came out of the 70s movement.
I don't know about here. That.
I know some people who worked there. Was it Phoenix House or something else? Penny Hanna worked there. Larry worked there. Larry Buckley worked there. Other people worked there. So it was for people who were in the harder drugs in the progress and not doing a clinical kind of thing, getting people to kick. So I think he ended up, I think Mick Wolf was around that for a while too. So Guido came down to kick, and he did. And then he, I'm sure Terry told me the story, I don't remember when he first came around the table, but he came around the table, and then he became a fixture at the table for better or worse for some people. But, you know, Terry helped him out a lot. He became the house player when someone else canceled, you know, was there. He would eventually bring down, you know, he brought Von Freeman down, John Young, Bebop Sam, other people. Frequently he brought him down. Actually, J.D. brought him down here. John Dalston.
That's okay. The story.
John had met Guido up there, and Guido had was talking about kicking, and John brought him down here.
And he was around for a long, long time. When did Guido die?
Guido had a series of strokes over a couple of years, but he died right after the table.
Right.
So, summer of 91, or fall 91, 92. Maybe it was 92, I think. Table was gone by the time he died, but by the closing of the table, he was all stroked out.
What, okay, so my first recollection of the table was, when would have that been? That would have been August of 86.
So you didn't go when you were in high school?
I take that back. I didn't go when I was in high school, but after I graduated high school, a friend of mine took me there, and the first time I was there, I was like 17, maybe 16, and Terry served me my first Anchor Porter, and he said, "Oh, you'll like this. Try this." And that was my first taste of beer that had, you know, wasn't commercialized, mass produced beer.
That was pretty heavy.
Yeah. but I remember starting to come around in August of 86. Because I'd gotten interested in playing percussion, and African percussion, and I found out about Oscar Soule at that point. And so I started coming to a lot of the Oscar Soule gigs. And that was how I found out about the table. So Oscar Soule...
That was Bantuku Prime.
Oh, yeah. That was primo stuff.
The first band.
That was great. So Oscar Soule was playing there a lot. This is... I'm talking 86, 87. So this would be firmly entrenched in the second... phase. So Oscar Soule was playing there on a regular basis. Guido Sinclair, of course. Who were some of the other big players at that point in time?
Sorghum.
Right.
Sorghum was really big. Catfish and Carter.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to look, because then, like, the last, like, 90 and 91, you know, some more of the bands had moved on. So it was, like, different bands.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at that point, we had, like, The Last Straw was one of the big draws,
mm-hmm.
Which was... what was what's now called alternative country, which wasn't
it didn't have a name
back then.
Yeah.
I mean, those were some of the weekend bands. I mean, the, mm-hmm. you know,
Danny Deckert was a big drummer in the scene at that point.
Yeah, he was a good drummer. But he was a good drummer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Helgeson's band played a lot. Ryan mm-hmm. Schultz played. I mean, there was, you know, it's big draws versus the great music. I mean, there were some of the bands that were great. I mean, Doc Scott was a pretty big staple too. And he was there in both parts of it, and he played quite a bit. And he had some great bands with Ryan Schultz, Mike Stryker, Danny Deckard, John Hurtubise, Helgeson's band. A lot of great stuff. And it was a place for a lot of musicians to grow
mm-hmm.
and to learn on stage. I mean, you know this. I mean, you don't just learn by studying it or playing it in the classroom. You've got to get out and play it. And that was always the thing that some people even though Garvey's band by the time. The table was really in its second phase or so. Garvey was pretty set in his ways. It was other people. I mean, his legacy was still going on, but he wasn't. People didn't want to be in the Garv band as much as be in Ray Sasaki's band
mm-hmm.
or whatever. So there was still. I mean, there was still a lot of things going on, but some of the big band people weren't into playing in small groups. So that would rub some people the wrong way. It's like, why aren't they coming out, man? Why aren't they checking out? Because they were more into playing their charts, doing the big stuff, and mm-hmm. not coming out and, you know, trying to blow over a tune for 15 minutes. or whatever. So, you know, so there was always attention there. I mean, famously, or infamously, I mean, Doc Scott had played every other Tuesday for, I don't know if it was a year, it seemed like a year, maybe it was half, like, maybe it was a semester. Maybe, and I worked Tuesday nights, well, I worked a lot of nights, but Tuesday is the one night I worked. And it would be Doc Scott alternating with Kevin Kaiser, with Raphael Garrett, and Tim Mulvana. And both, the nights were just, it was amazing music. And again, there was a handful of people came out. And Tuesday nights was Garv night, big band night at Trino's, which was just a block and a half up. And so Doc would get all surly, well, came in all surly. He'd get surlier and drunker. And during the break, he would put his posters like, real jazz with John Scott. Then he'd go up and he'd yell at people and say, you know, come hear some real jazz. You know, you got ears of stone, come hear real jazz. And, you know, of course, the Pied Piper effect did not work. He didn't come back with people following him after he harangued them. But he would go up during the break and yell at people at Trino's. So that would be a big draw for, like, for the Garv band.
Mm-hmm.
And the Garv band didn't really play there until, like, the last year or so at the table. It was kind of hard to set up a big band. And
yeah, it was a little tiny space. Why did it end?
Eminent Domain, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So some of us got involved in the end trying to save it. I mean, it was, as I mentioned earlier, the U of I had its eyes on that space for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because we really were surrounded by U of I on all sides. And that was a couple years. So by the late 80s, the original Strawberry Fields had gotten pushed out. They fought, though. They got pushed out by the Beckman Institute expansion. And they fought. They lost, but they fought. And so some of us, myself, like Scott Peterson, University YMCA, put together a group called U of I Watch, where we looked at the U of I master plan. We had a few forums. because their master plan kept on expanding into places regardless of what was there, because their master plan always talked about what was in U of I's interest, not what it was stepping on or pushing out. So we fought back, but it wasn't technically eminent domain because Terry didn't own the place. It was owned by Durso, who was going to sell.
Right.
So, and, you know, partially what was happening, too, is, as I mentioned earlier, Durso was a hands-off landlord, and he was older at that point, for sure, and I don't think the kids gave a shit about the building, really, and they just knew they were going to sell it eventually. So the building was deteriorating. There was a lot of stuff that needed repair. The roof sucked, you know. Air conditioner sucked, all this, you know. So it was kind of, unless it could get it rejuvenated, it was winding down. The physical plant was winding down.
Uh-huh.
And they eventually came up with their deadline of when it was going to be, which was first week of May, I think, of 91.
Now, when did people know what the date was?
I want to say it was 6 to 8 months or so prior, I believe.
And how long before that had people known that there was an active pursuit of going after the building?
Oh, I think people who knew that for a long time. I mean, I think Terry even knew it was inevitable. I mean, probably he didn't know that in 79, but by, say, 89, he probably knew that, or 88, mm-hmm. if not sooner.
Did he ever talk about it in those stark terms like
that?
Well, I think
we knew. I mean, because that building was a shithole in between. And, you know, it may have led to some of our rodent problems. Huh. I never saw it inside that, but I always had this impression that there was, like, a bunch of rats partying in there, or mice, just, like, a little den, and, you know, cigarettes and beer and hanging out and playing cards. And then they'd come and interlope on us after they got done, and, you know, after we were done for the night.
Uh-huh.
So it was pretty clear. I mean, they made their plant zone a long time ago. It's like, you know, so nobody could buy that space. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if Terry ever entertained the idea of moving, like, knocking down anything. He may have, but that was, they weren't going to let that happen.
Right.
They didn't want anything to, you know, continue to go there. And Dale, I mean, it may have been a year before. I mean, Dale knew, so Dale was able to move out. And they helped Dale. They actually gave Dale some reassistance stuff. So Horizon Books moved. It moved twice before it officially ended. But it moved once in the space above what's now Manolo's, but was Kinko's at the time, in the second story up there. So it was known, and, you know, we tried to do some efforts, you know, to raise some awareness. I think our efforts, probably what ended up doing, is they felt guilty enough that they did give Terry and Shelley a little bit of money for the business, because technically under eminent domain, like, all you really... And it wasn't technically eminent domain,
mm-hmm.
because the owners didn't fight it. But they got a buyout. And then I think Terry and Shelley got a few dollars. Mm-hmm. Which, that was partially due to our making it a public issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like they hadn't, you know... I mean, they were able to get by it for a little bit and some of that. But it wasn't a big thing. So then we planned, you know, to do a big blowout. Terry didn't want to, actually.
Talk about that. How did so Terry didn't want to do one?
No, I think he was just kind of depressed and didn't want it, you know, just wanted it to kind of fade away. And then mm-hmm. some of us talked him into doing it, and I said I would do all the work. Mm-hmm. Of course, he jumped in and did a bunch of work then, too. But I booked the bands. I mean, we did, it was really.
So this would have been, this is the last weekend, so this is May 10th, May 9th, 10th, and 11th of 91. So it would have been the second weekend of the month.
Yeah, I think there was a band on the Thursday. I think, like, the Strugs played, which I'd never played there before, but it was, like, Terry's old buddies. And, like, Charlie Weeks, I don't know if you know Charlie.
No, I don't know that.
He's old dead. He goes to the Hot Tuna camps all the time.
Okay.
Still. And they were just, like, a sludge garage band. They're all Terry's buddies. So they played one of the nights. Terry booked that one. I think it was one of the afternoons, I don't even remember. But so I booked it, you know, tried to get some people to come back. We got some people to come back. Not a lot of the early names could do it. But we did get Sorghum to come back and Chuck. And then the next day was a whole, I tried to put together a whole bunch of bands
mm-hmm.
to play. And then Terry brought, he had the RV at that point, which because they were going to go to Mexico. And they had the RV and they had plans. They were just going to go to, they were pulling the kids out of school for a year and going to Mexico. didn't end up being a whole year, but that was the plan. And so he brought the RV. He was cooking food. We just cranked out so much food. We were basically giving food away. I can't remember if I think we sold some, but we had lines out the door. I mean, it flowed out to the street. You were there, right?
I came back for a sorghum show. And
you missed the next day?
I missed the next day.
The next day was a real blowout. Because we started at like noon or something. I don't remember. And there was food. And then, you know, it flowed out. I mean, the crowd kept on swelling into the street. And actually, remember Jim Beckman?
No.
Channing Murray, red herring guy.
Okay.
He used to wear a cap all the time.
Yeah.
He had a little truck with speakers. And he came in like because Paul Wilnke was, WILL was recording the final weekend. And Jim hooked up into the feed and was putting it out into the parking lot. And this wasn't planned at all; it just kind of happened.
Oh, that's great!
So that like it could go outside because there was no way you couldn't even get in. I mean, it was so crowded. And we made a plan where some of us worked shifts, so we didn't all have to work the entire weekend. But at one point, the crowd got down swelling in the Goodwin. And I had to get up on top of my car, my Phoenix hatchback. And to tell the crowd, because the cops had come by, and I was like, get onto the sidewalk off. I mean, people were like, took over a whole lane of traffic at one point. So it got pretty big. And then eventually I think we locked the doors at like 2 o'clock. I think it went till 3 or later. I don't remember how late it went.
It went late,
and then some of us stayed later. Mm. And then the next day, Terry had a auction. Terry didn't stay the whole night, to the last note. But, he had an auction the next day, sold off a bunch of stuff. And then a bunch of us helped take stuff apart and tear things apart over the next few days. And then we got a call, I don't know if it was a month later or so, when they actually did the demolition. Because Allison Wood now, she had, I think it was like the beginning of Prairie Fire, her show that she did. Mm-hmm. And she did it, so they were out videotaping stuff. And I think she had gotten the call. And like that was happening. Mm-hmm. Actually, we were there twice. We were there the day that Terry turned over the keys to the face of evil, some fucker who he had to give the keys to. Not that you couldn't have just kicked any of the doors down to get in at that point, especially. But I think we were sitting there. But then the day we got the call that the cranes were showing up, it was like me, Terry, Jeff Michael, I don't remember who else. We got like a six-pack of Old Style, and we sat on the grass at Krenner and watched them tear it down. Mm. Well, WILL was out there too, mm-hmm. yesterday, because they filmed that being torn up. We were there watching it.
Yeah, the Prairie Fire episode that eventually aired, they made sure to insert the portion where the sign came down.
Yeah. Well, we had taken the front off the sign. The front of the sign was gone. And unfortunately, it probably got thrown away. It got stored. It actually got stored just like a couple blocks up here. Hmm. And Jeff Cross has had some storage space back there, just fields of stuff. Because some of the stuff went to White Street Arts Center, the piano. We were moving stuff out on the last day, and Terry had this like a van and then this open air trailer, and we had the piano on it and the toilet or two. And it started to rain as we were moving stuff. Hmm. And I remember just sitting on a toilet, trying to hold the toilet in and make sure nothing else slid in the back of the van while we drove to White Street. So yeah, a bunch of stuff went to White Street. The speakers, the PA, the tables and chairs Terry tried to sell or give away. I mean, I had some. Huh. Some went to his house. He took the walk-in cooler, went up to Circle Pines, which is an old like lefty/hippie camp in Michigan, mm-hmm. that a lot of people I'd known had gone to. Actually, I know some people now who send their people up there. But so he had like disassembled the walk in and took it up there.
Wow.
I think the oven may have gone there too. I'm not sure.
Man, I hope they're putting that thing to good use.
I'm sure it's all dead now. I'm sure the walk in is dead for sure. Mm. Oven possibly. Oven might have gone up there too. I think he might have taken them both up there.
That oven was really, there was a lot of bread that came out of that oven.
See, that was a pizza oven. See, that was that was for the pizza place. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of gave the bread the twist.
You were there for a long time. You saw a lot of neat stuff. I'm sure you got some stories to tell. What are some that you can share?
think for a second. Of course, I've got plenty. And then sometimes when people bring up things, more stuff comes up. Yeah, I'll try and focus on... Well, that thing's involved Guido. Mm-hmm. Well, there was some nights... So after Guido... And it wasn't until the late 80s, so many years after Guido. And this is... You know, I regret not knowing more stuff that I should have known. But you couldn't... It was unknowable at that point, or less knowable. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just do a Google search or get something. So, Guido told a lot of tall tales. And they didn't really make sense chronologically a lot of the time. At least the way I heard them. And so people were like, yeah, whatever. You've done shit, but that can't be true, or that's not true, or whatever. And then Raphael Garrett had heard about the place and heard about Guido. May have actually known Guido, not well, probably more by name and reputation. And they were both bebop cats at one point. Raphael was too. We didn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. But he had then played with Coltrane. We knew he was on Coltrane's Ohm and live in Seattle. And I didn't know that he was really involved with the AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians in Chicago, mm-hmm. which was founded in the late 60s.
It was one of the collectives at that point, right?
Yeah, it's still around.
Okay.
And had a lot of influence, and he was involved with that, which I didn't know at the time. But he was strung out, wanted to get away from the city, and came down here. So... They were too much alike to be friends or to get along, because then it kind of horned in on Guido's territory and vice versa. But there were some magical moments. So I mentioned Kevin Kaiser had really connected with Raphael. And did you ever see any of those gigs?
I never saw Raphael play with Guido, but
not with Guido, with Kevin.
Or no, I never saw those.
Okay,
but Raphael sat in with my band, The Spores, for one tune one night, and I had no idea who he was. And I think you told me after the fact who he was.
There is, I think it's the first Dewey Redman album. I think it's a quartet, I believe, and I've got it. And I didn't hear it for years after Raphael was dead. But it's like a quartet or quintet. It's driving, and that is prime Raphael, where the bass is driving, and he started doing this vocalizing along with it, and you can hear that is Raphael there, so he would Kaiser and the band, this guy Tim Mulvaney, ended up playing with Ken Vandermark for many years in Chicago.
What's his name?
Ken Vandermark.
Okay.
He was he got a MacArthur Genius Grant at one point in the 90s or early 2000s. Do avant-garde stuff, avant-garde jazz and driving jazz and a lot of other stuff. Mulvaney was a drummer for him for a long time and played a bunch in Chicago and still plays up there. But he was young then. Well, we were all young then. But he would drive down from Chicago, play the gig, and drive back every other Tuesday. It was just a trio with Kaiser and Raphael and that. And Raphael's endurance wasn't what it could be at that point, but there was at least a set and a half of near magical music that happened. And we'll get some of that, because Kevin recorded all of it, and at some point we'll get it. Tim doesn't have any of it. I already asked Tim.
And what's Tim's last name?
Mulvaney.
Mulvaney, okay.
But that was some of those moments where things just were amazing. Like, what was happening was just transcendent. There's the many sorghum nights where there was a lot going on. I mean, it was very crowded. There was a lot of great music. There were people, you know, trying to sit in or sitting in from the audience or doing whatever else. And, you know, Russell and Chuck and them always dealt with it. And there's a night that's partially captured on video. Crappy video, but video, where Russell was, they were doing one of the encores, which was Sex Machine, and he was singing Up, Get On Up, Up, Get On Up, and then his bench collapsed underneath him. He fell to the ground. Jelly almost dropped his sticks and fell. Chuck doubled over. Not even sure if Scott saw it at first. But then he just stood up and just kept on playing. And then Jelly and Chuck had to pull it back together and play. And that, so that was pretty funny.
There were
some problems with Bantuku at their peak, especially when they were playing Happy Hours. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the Happy Hours were great. So
so Happy Hours, 4 to 6, Fridays, red beans and rice was the specialty for...
Was it 4 to 6?
4 to 6.
Okay, good.
For red beans and rice for $1 a bowl. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
So for a long time, so Larry Gushy, who just actually passed away last year, he had New Golden Rule Orchestra, which was kind of... played a lot of the Happy Hour, so it was hot jazz, traditional jazz stuff. So those were really fun. And people would be lined up outside eating beans and rice. And I mean, you couldn't go wrong for a buck. You get a good bowl of brown rice and red beans. Those were fun. For a while there, so at some point, Bantuku was getting pretty big, and Scott Mordecai and this is a thing I might regret saying after I'm done, because some of the people are still alive. But it's a good story, I think. So Oscar somehow got into playing some of the Happy Hours, and it was at the peak of the first band and the madness of all the people who would show up. So it was crazy. And I think there were three of us working the bar and someone else helping out. So it was like me, Teresa Donnelly, and Eric Rubin. If you remember Eric Rubin, he was a good guy. So first of all, like, Scott had advertised the gig like as a 3-hour gig, and they were like, no, it's a 2-hour, because there was a band playing that night, it can't be a 3-hour gig. Mm-hmm. It's Happy Hour gig. And there was all this like commotion at the beginning, and then there was, the bar had been lowered. Bantuku played a lot of places. They played frat parties. They played a lot of places. So there was a lot of fucking chuckleheads showing up. And the place is packed. And it's like, you know, 5 o'clock on a Friday, and we're packed from, like, rafter to rafter. And some woman comes up asking for a towel because, so, you know, there was the ramp, and then there was, where it went down. Like, there was the raised part, and it went down. Mm-hmm. And she was, like, on the part down, and somebody had spilled beer on her head. Like, all over her head. So we figured, well, it's an accident, whatever, so we're trying to give her something to wash up. And then, so I'm going out there, like, with the mop to try to get through and mop it up. I see these fuckers spitting mouthfuls of beer at each other. Like, they would just take a mouthful of beer and spit at each other. In the table. Mm-hmm. So I dropped the mop, grabbed the dude by his shirt, threw him up against the wall, and just started screaming at him. And he had, like, 3 or 4 buddies around him. And they're all taller than me, of course. And then and they backed off. And then one talker came up, oh, blah, 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 it's okay, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, and then Eric was right back there. And then 10 minutes later, they're doing the same fucking thing. So me and Eric bum-rushed the fuckers out. We got them out of the fucking place. Hmm. There was a little bit of a commotion, but we got them the fuck out of there. But Eric had my back.
Now, you bring up a good point, which is, I don't ever remember there being any kind of serious trouble at the table.
I bounced people.
Yeah?
Terry bounced people.
Yeah?
It happened.
Okay.
There was this guy, Zen. And Russell knows his real name. I never knew his real name. I just knew him as Zen the Poet. Older African-American guy. Well, probably not older. He was probably 40.
Well, to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Junkie. Poet, whatever, he would come by, and I think once we caught him, I think the night that he got, it was a full night, there was some construction going on Goodwin, so right in on the sidewalk, I think, so right in front of the big window in the big room, there was some construction horses, mm-hmm. And I think, like, Zen had been, we cut him off. I mean, the problem, we never had, well, except for these boneheads, we never had, well, they were probably legal, we never had problems with, like, the 18-year-olds or the 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds, mm-hmm. who were in the, we had problems with the older people usually. I think Zen was like, because we had always had beer bottles on the tables with flowers in them, but they had water in them. Mm-hmm. And he was taking the flowers out and drinking it, thinking it was beer. I mean, he was so fucked up. And I think Terry got him out, And then he, and the place was full. I can't remember who was playing. He picked up one of the horses and threw it at the window, and it bounced off. But Terry's football moves, like, we were, like, on, like, the ledge and the landing part. And all of a sudden, I looked, and Terry was, like, had Zen, like, up the block. Like, Terry was just, like, and he had him out. I mean, he was so, like, he had him, like, halfway up the block, gone.
Wow.
But, I mean, but that, if that had gone through the window, a lot of people would have gotten hurt. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, however he threw it or whatever else, it just hit it, and it bounced off the window. Because he was pissed because he got kicked out because he couldn't drink the water out of the the flower water.
What's the name of that movie? Please Don't Eat the Daisies.
There was some, you know, confrontations between. I have a great one, and these people are all dead now. So
okay,
this is kind of the rough edge, the Chicago edge. So Guido would bring Von Freeman down to play. So. It was a great night, and when Guido would book a gig, he would kind of do door. You remember how the door? I mean, the door was loose, but
it was a bucket at the front of the door.
Yeah. And Terry told a great story about the bucket at one of the reunions. I can't remember what it was right now. It was fucking hilarious. It was basically, the bucket originally had $1 or $2. Like, it written down on one side, so like Terry'd be like $2. No, $1 or whatever. So it would be like, and that's what it was. But we would charge like a whopping like $5 for like Von Freeman. It'd be Von and John Young. I mean, it was mostly a Chicago band. But Guido booked it, so Guido would take the door or whatever. And it was packed. And like Guido would sit down on one tune or two. But, I mean, Von and him legitimately knew each other. But, I mean, Von was Guido's, one of his idols. I mean, Von was a tough motherfucker. So I have a bunch of stories that involve Guido getting punched. So end of the night, now I'm working the bar, I don't remember with who else. Guido gives the money to Van, and Van's like, He goes, go, let's step in here. And so we had our two bathrooms, the big bathroom and the small bathroom. The big one, the supposedly handicapped one, and then the small one, which was pretty small. So he pulled him into the big bathroom, and he's here. And then Von comes out counting all the money. Everything's all right now.
Wow.
And then there was a night. So Doc Scott's playing one of these great nights with Metal on Flesh band. And there's nobody there. And Brian Ruth shows up with his skateboard. He'd been skateboarding on the Krennert steps or whatever. He's out and Guido's hanging out. And Guido's like, and the band's still playing, he's like, hey man, do one of them tricks for me. And like Brian did, like, where he flipped his skateboard, but it's on the raised ramp, so it made a really loud noise. So Doc looked up, because he's playing. Like this look of fucking fury. And then the set ended soon afterwards, and he came up, he grabbed Guido by the fucking shirt, threw him up against the wall, like ripped off his glasses and threw him across the place and just screaming at him. And Guido was pretty fucking built still at that point, and Doc was very built too. And there he's just screaming at him, holding him up, and it's like what the fuck? Because Guido did it to fuck. Like Brian was like the pawn. Mm-hmm. He should have known, but he shouldn't have done it. But Guido was kind of fucking with Doc in a way. And so Doc, I mean, he didn't punch him. He just threw him up against the wall, and then Guido couldn't find his glasses and all this shit. So that was going on.
What about some stories from the kitchen?
The kitchen. The kitchen, we would often fire on all cylinders, and I'm sure you were around for some of those. Mm-hmm. We had different crews. The other was, you know, Brian Reedy, when Jeff Michael was in the kitchen, not behind the, not by the stove, but when Robin worked or other people worked, when Rosie, Liz... I don't know. So we would often rotate. I mean, I was an opener, so the cook would come in and start making the bread early in the morning when Jeff was doing it, not early enough, usually. Then I would come in and slice the meat, slice the cheese, get Munster cheese all in my hair and beard. have to clean the fucking slicer. But then start setting up the sandwich, like the sandwich prep area. We'd have to wipe all the tables down. I mean, we'd mop at the end of the night, so put all the tables down. Everybody else would come in, and then we would rotate between. We usually have, like, two people on the counter taking orders, a person on dishes, two people on the sandwich table. And then sometimes the cook would still be there, and then sometimes if we ran out of something, we have to make something quickly or whatever. And then lots of times Terry would come and make a guest appearance and jump in and do some dishes and start telling jokes and stuff. So when we were cranking, we were cranking. I mean, jokes were flying, shit was happening. We were making sandwiches fast as could fucking be, flying them out the door. I still see, I see Half Tuna Bruce. So there was Bruce and Clark, who, like, it was Quarter Gondolette Clark, Half Tuna Bruce, I think, Half Tuna Charlie. Like, some of these people would have their same sandwiches right. every, because they worked next to, like, every day, and we'd see them in the line, and we'd have their sandwich ready and give it to them when they came up to the counter. They loved that. But yeah, and then, you know, people would go out and bust the tables, because everybody ordered at the counter. So people would go out and bust the tables and do the dishes. Brian Reedy was a dish monster for a long time. And we'd have to, and then there would always be the beast, which was where all the dough, that was the big food processor.
Yeah, it was the big bowl.
Yeah.
And that was, I remember watching that on many occasions.
Called the beast, and that would always be, would suck to never get collapsed.
Well, the thing about having to wash that is that it slowed everything else down, and it took forever to wash it and rinse it.
It barely fit in the sink.
Yeah, it was a real pain in the ass.
Well, then there was, like, when Terry had, like, different things came up. Like, Terry had ice cream for a while, and it was in the freezer right where we put all the dishes. So you have to go, like, so that was a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. Then there was the jewelry stuff, which ended up taking up, like, a third of the counter at one point. It was, like, this Mexican jewelry in this big container, which we never sold much of, but it was on the counter. Mm-hmm. And we sold T-shirts. I do remember whenever if the cops ever came by, Terry would always hide and make me deal with them. Like, hide in the office.
I don't remember them ever coming by at any shift that I worked.
Yeah, they came by once or twice. Mm-hmm. Wasn't very often, but...
Was it random, or were they responding to noise, or what?
No, it wasn't a noise. It was, like, early in the day, so I don't remember what it was. Hmm. I don't remember. I remember once or twice that Terry would run and hide. You deal with it, Jeff. Well, there was, you know, moving those kegs in was insane. So the back door was just, we'd often have that shitty screen door.
It was just a screen.
That wasn't even attached, that would just fit in there. And then there was that little wooden step down into the back storage room, and then we had to get it into the walk-in, and those, and getting those kegs down, like unloading them and getting them in there, was always a fun time. Mm-hmm. And then getting them back out, and then arranging the walk-in. I remember arranging that walk-in was tiny, with all the food, and then when all the beer deliveries would come on Friday, I believe, and trying to stack everything so we could get it, and having all the bottles underneath, and knowing where the bottles were to make sure we get the right bottles, mm-hmm. and people would come. And then I do remember, if not once, twice, the health inspector shut the walk-in down.
Oh, talk about that. I don't remember.
Well,
that.
It was, like, you know, summertime. You know, what do we have, like a window unit? I mean, we didn't have central air.
Right.
Just a couple window units in there. Then there was the extractor fan. But so the oven was like 5 feet from the walk-in cooler. And so we're cranking out bread for hours, then making hot soup, and then putting it in plastic containers to cool in there. And I think I was there both times. He came by, and the soup was way too hot still. And the temperature of the cooler, because, you know, it was in the, like, it would cool down later. Mm-hmm. And he fucking put, like, yellow tape on the cooler, and he made Terry throw all the food out, and he made him watch him throw it in the dump. Like, we couldn't even give it away.
Wow.
Like, all the meat and all the meat and the soup that had been made that day, and all the sliced meat and other stuff that was in there. Mm. I think it happened twice. That sucked. Jim Roberts. So that wasn't fun.
Nope. Any other stories that really stand out to you? Moments?
Yeah, I missed the time that... I think I missed a couple things. I missed... I think Oscar pulled a knife on Guido. I missed that night in the kitchen. Or did Guido pull the knife on Oscar? I don't remember now. I think there was a Raphael and Guido dust up in the kitchen one night. I missed that. Here's a great one. I told this actually to Mikael Bruin recently. He had never heard it before. So you know who Herbert Bruin was?
No.
So Herbert was one of the cutting edge computer music people who came here in the like early mid-60s. He was a Holocaust survivor, had gone through Europe and stuff, ended up here. He was here like with Sal Moderano and like when John Cage was here for a short while. Yeah. So U of I was big into the computer music thing. And Herbert was more than just a computer music person. He was like a whole philosophy. A school developed around him, around seminars, and there was a lot of people that followed Herbert Bruin's thought that were composers and then political activists. So they were having a conference on some sort, and Herbert had one of his times in exile from Germany had played cabaret music. And he had approached Guido about doing a gig during this conference. So they would have a bunch of people in town. Herbert would do something he didn't do because he didn't play piano. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not what his... I mean, he played piano, but that's not what people knew of him. And mm-hmm. So this would be a different... You know, seeing him differently. So Guido was up for it, and Terry Gaiman died. It was like a Saturday night or whatever. So the place filled up, mostly with the conference people. Susan Parenti and a bunch of other people, and Herbert, and it was Herbert and Leon Jeter on cello and Guido and somebody else, and it was nice. And they did a set, and then Guido had also hired a jazz band to play, Danny Deckard and like John Hurtubise and some other people, and didn't tell either band that he was doing that. So he pissed off everybody because people had come to hear Herbert and people had paid the cover to hear Herbert. But then Danny and those guys didn't know what was going on. And so Herbert was a pretty old man at this point, way older than Guido. He was probably 70 or something at that point. And, you know, compact, but shorter than Guido. And people were just screaming at Guido, started yelling at Guido, like all over the place. And then... again, up against the chalkboard, Herbert is like, I'm behind the bar, so I couldn't hear anything. He's like, boom! Punches him in the chest. Guido bounces off the chalkboard, comes back up. Herbert's like, boom! Hits him again and bounces him off the chest. I told the story to Mikael, one of Herbert's sons recently, and he had never heard that before. I said, he's like, that's like not really what their dad did, but I was like, yeah, it's like Guido could bring out the worst in people. He was just so pissed off everybody. That was pretty funny. Guido was just sheepish, like, because he knew he was wrong. Right. He knew he was fucking everybody over. Like, everybody.
How did the table change you?
How did the table change me? Well, it gave me a place to really... I mean, I had listened to jazz. I was not a jazz non-listener when I started there. It gave me a place to really learn the music. It gave me a job when I was doing a lot of political organizing. It gave me a job when I stopped being a student, which was partially due to the political organizing. And between that and the anti-apartheid movement were the first times I was in charge of people, in charge of organizing things and pulling things together. So it honed some of those skills. Again, I got to hear... I mean, I look back at some of those schedules and it's like, oh, why didn't I go see that? Why didn't I hear that? I mean, I heard a lot. But it's like there was so much more to hear. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it was amazing what, you know, what there was to hear. I mean, I often didn't go to other places. I went to Mabel's every once in a while to hear some music, but ended up at the table a lot. Got to make, really good friends, and got to learn from Terry, and work side by side with Terry, and see Terry grow too. Terry, we pushed Terry. I mean, Terry, we started selling, we had table shirts always, but then he, during the anti-chief stuff, Charlene Teeters would come in there, and Terry started selling near the end. We were selling the No Racist Mascot shirts, whatever, or the Native American, which was shirts were there? There's a picture in the background of some of this stuff, but advertising stuff like that. I mean, you always had stuff where we put up posters and things like that, so it was a place for political discussion to happen, mm-hmm. and arguments, mm-hmm. and so, I mean, that's why, I'll buy Terry a beer, or did while he was still around, or Shelley, or buy stuff for Russell when he wants music. I mean, a lot of invaluable stuff that I got there that I got for very little or cheap. I mean, I don't remember. I mean, I didn't make a lot of money, but I don't remember, spending every dollar there. And it was, up to that point, and probably still one of the best bosses. I've had other good bosses since then, not directly after, but later. But one of the best bosses who, Terry really knew how to, behind the scenes, coordinate people, mm-hmm. figure out what people's strengths were and skills were, kind of put them in that place, and rely on them to do that. I think the earlier years, Terry had to do more of everything, mm-hmm. and then when a few of us came forward, me and some other people came forward, he was able to rely on people a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And I think that felt good for him. I was despite what some people say, Terry always told me I was the first and really only manager that he had. Other people will say otherwise, but mm-hmm. I don't believe him. Because I don't think that was true. But I'm sure there's plenty more stories, but what's the other highlights? Well, here, I'll tell you one closing weekend story that epitomizes the yin-yang of the Guido. So Guido would often... There was a school of Guido. Mm-hmm. And Guido would school people in how to play the music and to understand how to get ripped off. Because Guido would not steer the money, and he would... often borrow money and things like that. So he'd end up pissing off a lot of people. So he'd often get younger and younger bands because other people wouldn't play with them because they'd be pissed him off, or he'd be so high that, he'd fuck things up. But, there were moments of brilliance even till the end. So he had this band, really good band, that he'd worked for a while. His last working band, it was Tom Painter on piano, Kevin Engel on tenor sax, Justin Kramer on drums, Elliot Torres on bass. And they smoked. They were all really good players. And they worked with Guido, and they were a tight band. And I had approached Kevin and said, hey, would you do a Guido tribute at the table the last weekend? And he's like, nah, fuck him. Fucking asshole. He had done something to piss off. Even though he had a stroke at that point and stuff. He's like, no, but I'll play a gig and I'll play some Guido tunes. How about that? And I'm like, okay, fair enough. So I think Guido was in the nursing home at that point. He was pretty stroked out. He couldn't talk, really. He was paralyzed on, maybe most of his right side or whatever. But so they were, starting this set or whatever. And then I think it's a cousin of Shirley, or nephew of Shirley's. We called him Brain Dead Fred. I'm not sure what his real name was.
Oh, who's Shirley, though?
Shirley Blankenship, Guido's ex-wife.
Right.
So Brain Dead Fred and one of his no-good buddies went and picked up Guido. Got him from the nursing home. So Guido shows up, and so everybody's like, Guido, Guido. And he's like, he couldn't talk, but he was smiling ear to ear. And he went up to the bar and asked for an Old Style, even though he couldn't really drink it. And Guido would always get a can of Old Style, and he'd wrap a napkin around it, hold the napkin. And so he did that, and he's sitting there with the can of Old Style. He took a sip, he couldn't even really drink it, he could barely hold it. and then he's in the front room, and Kevin sees him there, and he's like, you know, I'm glad my good friend and mentor Guido is here, Guido Sinclair is here, and I'm going to play, you know, we're going to play now one of Guido's songs. And I can't remember which one it was, but then Kevin just, like, lit into it, and the band just lit into it, and Guido's got this, you know, smile on his face. It's a beautiful moment. And then the tune goes on, and then the song ends, and Kevin looks over, and Guido's gone, because he went out to get high with Brain Dead Fred and whoever else. Hmm. So perfect. So, like, Kevin looks over for affirmation at the end, and Guido's not there. So it was like, you couldn't even stay the one tune. So.
All right. Any final thoughts?
That's a good ending point.
Fair enough.
Because right. It captured everything.
It sure did.
It was
did.
Like almost fucking crying at how beautiful it was, and then the great artistic moment, and then way to fuck it up, Guido.
Cool. Well, it's August 19th, and we've been talking with Jeff Machota about Nature's Table. Thanks, Jeff.